Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear John LaSala saying, "Hey folks, this is John LaSala." On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Joe Gentry-Hamer. So here goes.
Hey folks, this is John LaSala. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Joe Gentry-Hamer.
And I thought, shit, 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 fuck, fuck, fuck. If the cops get here, there's going to be a confrontation, and he's going to fucking blow us both up.
See? This all makes perfect sense. But listen, before we get underway, have you been hearing these stories we've been running on some of the Wednesdays where I get together with a storyteller and they just tell me their story one-on-one? We get to chat through it. There's one with Nate Runkle. There's one with Dawn Jewel Fraser. And tomorrow, there'll be a brand new one with my friend Jean LeBeck. You don't want to miss that. And after that, maybe you could come on and tell me a little story. Just email me at kevin@risk-show.com and let's chat.
We'll be right back.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Now here's the show. Folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is John LaSala.
Hello!
John is one of the handful of people behind the scenes here at Risk that make this podcast actually happen. But today, he'll be your guest host for the rest of the episode. And with that, I'll just skedaddle and leave you to it.
Thanks, Kevin. Hey, you know, Kevin will be back with you very soon, but I'll take good care of you. I promise. So for now, let's you and me get on with the business of today's episode. Firstly, if you're thinking the music we've been hearing has the unmistakable production quality of the late, great David Axelrod, you're right. But it's actually House of Mirrors by the late David McCallum, an actor who I know from his vintage recordings of H.P. Lovecraft tales.
That is what they say I said when they found me in the blackness after 3 hours. Found me crouching in the blackness over the plump, half-eaten body of Captain Norris, with my own cat leaping and tearing at my throat.
And so we're calling this week's episode Dark Sides. And I told my colleagues I couldn't promise to refrain from making Star Wars references at this point, but I will try. I'll just keep with the Eldritch Horror for now. And so, much like the narrator of Lovecraft's The Rats in the Walls, some folks, arguably most folks, have a dark side. It may be deep down there, and maybe it will never see the light of day. But in today's episode, we'll hear two tales from people who unwittingly encountered the dark sides of the otherwise pleasant people in their lives. Later on, we're going to hear from musician and jewelsmith Joe Gentry Hamer. But we'll start with a story that David Beck told at our live show in Caveat in New York City last November. So let's get to it. Here's David with The Huntsman.
Well, on such a beautiful night like tonight, at the end of a gorgeous day, which was today, I thought it would be good to end this show with a romance. And like many great romances, this one begins in the theater. But not just any theater. A rec center in suburban Kettering, Ohio, in the year 1996. Doing children's theater. A play you might have heard of, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He was 15. I was 12. He was cast as the pivotal role of the Huntsman. I was cast as an extra, doing offstage live sound effects. You see, I was originally cast to play the piano because I play the piano. Originally, it was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the musical. But a week into rehearsals, the director realized that the actress playing Snow White, not only did she have hair as black as ebony and lips as red as blood and skin as white as snow, but she was also quite tone deaf. Yeah. The bitch couldn't sing. So the director told me, David, it's not a musical anymore. The piano is out. And I said, but can I just play the piano like one song to make my mom happy? You see, I lived in fear of my mother's approval. All I wanted was to make her happy. But the director was like, no, the piano's out. So she changed the whole concept of the play. Remember, this was at a rec center children's theater in Kettering, Ohio. I mean, the fact that she had a concept for the play was like a little insane. But so now it was Snow White set during the Renaissance. So she said, there's no piano during the Renaissance. So anyway, the piano's out. The reason why I'm telling you this whole backstory is, had I in fact played the piano for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs the musical, I would not be standing here telling you this story today. I might be at Birdland, like playing the piano, like making something of my life, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. So the Huntsman, 15 years old. Now, to be quite honest, he was not the ideal Huntsman. He was a little big, and he was kind of swishy around the hips, and he spoke with an affected British accent when he acted. But to be honest, we all, child thespians in Kettering, Ohio in 1997, we all spoke with an affected British accent. That was how you acted, right? So I have to give him credit for that. But he did possess one characteristic that was quite appropriate for the Huntsman in Snow White. He had brazen rebellion. Yes, this Huntsman was a rebel rouser. And for some reason, I was often the subject of his rousing. So during the rehearsal process, always in front of a group of girls, he would tease me, and he'd be like, David, just admit that you're bisexual. Come on, just admit you're bisexual. And I was like, I am not bisexual. You see, I didn't even really know what bisexual was at the age of 12. I definitely knew what homosexual was, and I definitely was not homosexual. I will tell you right now, because my mother told me I am not homosexual. You see, growing up, I went to Catholic school for 13 years, and this was suburban Ohio, and I had never met a bisexual. I had never met a homosexual. And I knew that if I had met a homosexual, I had to pray for them because they were going to go to hell. And I certainly was not going to go to hell, especially because of this Huntsman. So anyway, so he would tease me, and during Tech Week, when we were fully inflamed in our costumes, which included pantaloons and tights and slip-on ballet shoes and heavy stage makeup. Remember, we weren't homosexual, we were actors. The teasing somehow became a little more seductive and a little more intimate, and he would somehow do it when we were alone. There were no girls around anymore. And he would say, "Just say it. Just say you're bisexual. Just tell me. Say the word bisexual." And at this point, I didn't deny it, but I would just kind of stare at him, frozen, not knowing what to do. And then one day he just kissed me. And I didn't know what to do. I was totally frozen. I just like stood there like completely stiff. And he used his tongue. He used a lot of tongue. And he would kind of like slobber all over my face and all over my lips. And I didn't know to open my mouth. I was 12. I had never been kissed before at all. And, you know, he did this a few times. And every time I would get slobber all over my mouth. And then one time he called me out and he said, "Listen, I'm sorry for getting slobber all over your mouth, but you don't open your mouth." So after this exposure, which was quite humiliating, I said, "You know what? The next time he kisses me," which I knew there was going to be a next time, "I'm going to go for it." So the next time he kissed me, we were backstage, and I just went for it. And when our tongues kissed, it was like this surge of power came over me. And I could tell that he got excited too. And then he started touching me in all these weird places. I mean, not weird, but, you know, places I'd never been touched before. So I was backstage doing the live sound effects. And, you know, if you might recall from the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the Huntsman makes a big splash in the first act in the beginning. He saves Snow White, and then he kind of, you know, is MIA for the rest of the story. So this Huntsman had a lot of time on his hands. So I would be backstage, relegated in my little corner of sound effects. You know, I had a glockenspiel and a rain stick for when the evil queen makes her transformation to the Wicked Witch. And then I had a bass drum for when Snow White eats the poisonous apple and dies. It was very dramatic. So I would be doing the bass drum, you know, standing there, and he would come around me, and he put his hands underneath my pantaloons, underneath my tights, underneath my boxers, so it was skin on skin contact, and he would like knead my ass like it was bread, and then he like started making out with the back of my neck, and I was busy working, and I didn't know what to do, but I loved it. It was so exciting. But I was struggling, you know. At one point, when he was sitting next to me, I thumped him with the stick on the head. I was so mad. And that's what I was. I struggled with sexuality, and I didn't want to be bisexual. I didn't want to be homosexual because I was going to hell. And I said, "You're not going to go to hell. We're not going to go to hell." And that was that. So it was pretty exciting, these salacious Snow White makeout sessions. But it got a little more intense each time. And he started grabbing me and trying to touch me in you know where, the place that I did not want to be touched. Because at this point I had like a raging, you know, boner, and I didn't want him to touch it. Because if he touched it, then that's proof that I was enjoying it, and that, you know, there's no denying it after that, you know. And we kind of like were making out, and I had like one arm like wrapped around like his silk blue cape, and it was, and then I had like the other like arm like fending him off, and then he was stronger than me. He was 15 and he was bigger than me, and so he kind of pushed me, and then he just grabbed it, and then he squeezed it, and I thought I was gonna die, and I pushed him off me, and then I ran to the nearest bathroom. I didn't even care about the sound effects anymore, and I pulled down my pants and I inspected myself. Thankfully, it hadn't fallen off. But I knew At that moment, my 12-year-old virtue had indeed been rotted. After Snow White and the Seven Dwarves ended, I lost touch with the huntsman. It was springtime, and then summer came. We were free, and I decided I'm gonna be an actor. I knew that this thing, this realization, you know, this awakening, there was no going back from it, but I had to sort of put it in a box. And I decided that summer that I was gonna just lose myself in acting and lose myself in music and lose myself in theater. And that was the first time where I consciously realized and decided that art was gonna save my life. You know, I can escape through art in order to not worry about my own life. And I still do that to this day. That's why I'm here. Yes, yes. All right, good. But I did not forget the huntsman completely. And I would practice with my tongue, because I didn't have his tongue. My finger would be his tongue, and I would sort of like make out and practice, you know, secretly. Eighth grade rolls around, fall comes, and I'm excited because the rec center children's theater in Kettering is doing The Hobbit. And I love The Hobbit. And I was like, this is my chance. Now, the huntsman, unfortunately, is 16 years old, and he's a sophomore in high school, so he's no longer eligible for the Children's Theater Rec Center plays. So he wasn't even involved at all. But I auditioned, and I got the role of Gandalf, the pivotal role, the lead. Yes, I mean, yes. Thank you so much. It was stupendous. Yes. So I was so excited because I had an amazing costume and I had this crazy like blue hat and I had this like gray beard and I had all this crazy old stage makeup and I had this silk blue cape, the same silk blue cape that the huntsman wore. So occasionally I would feel the cape and that would immediately bring me back to those salacious Snow White makeout sessions. But I didn't let myself indulge too much because I had a job to do. I was Gandalf, for Christ's sake. So I lost myself in the theater. On opening night, lo and behold, who shows up in the audience? Yes, the huntsman. Shocked. I was even more shocked when the huntsman decided to come to our opening night party at the family-friendly pizza joint Marion's. So I kind of said my awkward hello and then kind of like went off to a table in the corner with a group of girlfriends and we sort of gossiped and, you know, talked about our dreams and our goals for life and, you know, how you usually do. But I kept one eye on that huntsman and he was off playing with a group of boys, probably in the fourth and fifth grade, young boys. And he was 16 at this moment. And I saw him and I watched him kind of like touch them playfully, but somehow quite sinisterly. And I couldn't help ask myself, am I jealous? On the car ride home, my dad had a few things to say about the huntsman.
Oh man, David, that huntsman, he's creepy. What is he doing hanging out with those little kids for? Oh, he's creepy.
And that word creepy, that really, I didn't like that word creepy at all. Was he creepy? And was I creepy for liking him? And again, I had this struggle with being raised Catholic and thinking homosexuality is a sin and is it creepy? Anyway, so high school comes around, college comes, I go to drama school in New York City. I flee Kettering, Ohio. Years later, takes me years, I... Free like a bird. I come out of the closet to my friends, and then a few years later to my family, and it's very difficult, but, you know, we're getting through it. At this point, I'm in my mid-20s. I'm in a loving, committed relationship with a man. Very exciting, very exciting. And I'm drunk one day in my 20s, and I am going down a Facebook rabbit hole, you know? Maybe it was MySpace, I don't know. But but I look for the Huntsman. I Google Huntsman, and I can't find him. And I search and I search and I search, and probably an hour later, I find him. Oh my God, there he is. Those sly brown eyes staring right back at me, and the saddest mugshot I have ever seen. There he is, my Huntsman, a registered sex offender. Yeah. The questions that just popped into my brain, I mean, and then I remembered. I conveniently left out when we made out when I was 12, he would always put my hand in his pants, and he was never aroused. And that always made me a little quizzical. I was like, is he not enjoying this like I'm enjoying it? Like, is this some sort of power play? And then I was like, oh, was I his first victim? And I was like, oh my God. And then I was like, was I? No. Was I molested? No. And then I was so confused. And then I dreamt that I visited him in prison. I don't even know if he's in prison. And I interrogated him and I questioned him and I wanted answers. And then we made out. And then he showed me his rain stick. And then after the initial shock wore off, I realized, why do I know this? I think it's crazy how we can just Google anyone from our past now and just find out these details about them and these truths. And do I really need to know this little piece? I mean, is it making my life better somehow? No, not at all. I never again fantasized about the Huntsman. I still do have questions to this day, but some questions are just better left unanswered. Thank you so much.
When the huntsman came home, it was nearly spring. I opened my door, gave him the last of our bread, but the meat I'd made I hid from him. I didn't love him. And if you'll be the wolf with the wolfskin on your back, who howls for the night, stares with red eyes, will I be the bird with the broken wing? And will I sing?
This is The Huntsman by Allison Callery. And that was David Beck with a story by that same name, edited by Taj Easton. And what timing on having his story on the podcast this week, because David has a feature film premiering at Dances with Films in LA at 7 p.m. on June 27th. It's called Regarding Us, and the trailer looks amazing, like totally something Risk listeners would appreciate too. So this Thursday, if you're anywhere near the TCL Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, you know, the place where Star Wars premiered in 1977, well then go see it. More at danceswithfilms.com or check out David on Instagram and TikTok at DavidBeckNYC.
Relationships are hard, and that's why I'm here. Hey friend, it's Cami Crawford. You may know me from my work on MTV's Catfish, and I hope you'll join me on my show, Relationshit, the advice podcast that covers all relationship topics. It's a judgment-free zone, and nothing is off-limits. Think of me as your big sister / Audible BFF that you can always trust to give you the real tea. Listen and follow Relationshit with Cami Crawford, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
It's me, John LaSala, and this is Unquiet Slumbers for the Sleepers behind me. It's Genesis from 1976. I was only 2 at the time. It's kind of darkly beautiful, isn't it? Anyway, one of our patrons, Jada Selma, recently included this little note along with her pledge. For Risk, the podcast that showed me my story matters by providing stories that matter to me. Love, Jada, an aspiring storyteller. Jada, thank you so much. I hope to hear a story from you on Risk someday, too. And thanks to you and all the Jadas out there for supporting what you love through Patreon or through other means. But for Patreon supporters, we have a new bonus story out right now from Kate Willett, and it sounds precisely like this.
And, you know, I say to him, I was like, look, some of the things that you have said on the internet are a little sexist, and I'm worried about that. And he confides in me. He's like, I'm actually not sexist. I'm a sub. I just take it at face value, right? I'm like, at least he fantasizes about respecting women, so.
Except longer. Get the rest of it and gazillions of other stories at patreon.com/risk. Next, we're going to hear from Joe Gentry-Hamer. Jo is one hell of a cool lady, and she told me this story back in October of 2023 from what looked like a workbench in a jeweler's shop. More about that later. For now, let's hear that story I'm calling This Side of the Dirt.
I was 18 years old, and I was living in a small apartment in working class neighborhood in North Hollywood, California. I was living with my soon-to-be ex-husband and our newborn son. My husband's family lived across the street from us. Next to them were their neighbors, Jane and Bob. Jane and Bob were salt-of-the-earth working class people, very friendly, very kind, you know, just visit with them all the time. And so Jane worked in an office to support the family across town. And Bob, well, Bob was a Korean War vet who'd seen some combat. And not surprisingly, he had a bit of a drinking problem. But he supplemented their income by breeding Great Dane puppies. And he was good at it. So one lovely, typical sunny Southern California day, my husband and I were across the street at his family's house, and we were just hanging out, and the family members were passing the baby around and cooing over him and everything. And all in all, it was a pretty terrific day. But then their telephone rang. And my sister-in-law, my young teenage sister-in-law, picked up the phone, and my husband and I were close enough that we could hear Jane's voice on the line, and she sounded frantic. And we could hear her say, Bob and I had a fight yesterday, and he just called me at work, and he says he's going to kill himself. Could somebody please go next door and check in on him? So my husband and I took off like a shot, and we could see as soon as we exited the family home that his beautiful, big, gorgeous, sweet Great Dane bitch was tied up outside in the bright sun. And we thought, oh, fuck, this is bad. This is really bad. Bob loved that girl. He would never do that to her. So we run up to the front door, knock on the door. There's no answer. We try the door. It's locked, which was uncharacteristic of them. And so we started to go around the side of the house and head for the back door, and it was locked too. And we noticed as we were walking around the house that all the curtains were drawn. Yeah. And so we think, oh God, this is not good. And so we wandered around to the far end of the house and looked up, and we could see a smallish horizontal rectangular sliding glass window way up high over the bathroom. It was one of those tiny little bathroom windows up way high. And we could see that it was cracked ever so slightly. So my husband boosted me up. I grabbed onto the windowsill and I started to wiggle with one hand and get it to move a little bit. And my husband said, oh, listen, see if you can get that open far enough so you can crawl in and unlock the front door, and I'll see what I can do. And so I wiggled the window some more, and it was a tough fit, but I managed to squeeze through, and I dropped to the bathroom floor, and the house was pitch black. The only light that was coming into the house was that tiny little beam of light coming from way up high. So I took a second, and then I started to tiptoe up the hallway from that end of the house to the front. And it was so pitch black, I had to feel my way with my left hand on the hallway wall. About halfway up the hall, I could smell gas. And I thought, oh shit, Bob really means this. He's really, oh my God, this is some serious ass shit. And so I continue to tiptoe as quietly as I could up the hallway and holding the wall. And just as I was about to round the corner and reach the front door, Bob lunged out of the dark and grabbed my right arm and dragged me into the kitchen. And I can still taste that horrible metallic taste of adrenaline shooting up the back of my throat. My heart was pounding so hard I thought it was going to pound out of my chest. I was fucking freaked out. And when he dragged me into the kitchen, in the dim, very dim light, I could see that the stove had been pulled away from the wall and it had been disconnected from the gas main. And there was gas pouring out of the wall. And I flinched a little and tried to pull away, and he just grabbed me tighter and pulled me closer to the stove. And I look up at him, and he's sobbing and crying. He's got tears streaming down his face. He's got snot pouring out of his nose. I can smell the booze on him, you know, and barely over the gas. And then I look up, and he's got a Zippo lighter in his left hand, and he's waving it around. And I'm thinking, shit, 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 fuck, fuck, fuck. I'm going to die here today. I'm going to oh, my God, if he hits that lighter, this house is going to go up in a ball of fire. There's going to be nothing left of this place but a crater in the ground. And our body parts are going to be scattered all over the yard. And then, of course, my brain went to, oh, my God, my son. I'm never going to see him again. I was pretty tense and starting to freak out a little bit. And then he was just sobbing. And then he was ranting and saying, oh, I'm a horrible man. I'm a bad man. I hit Jane. I'm no good. I'm no fucking good. I hit my wife. I hurt my wife. And I'm just no good. Oh, God, I'm a horrible person. I'm a bad man. I can't live like this anymore. I know my wife hates me now, and my son hates me, and I'm just no good to anybody. I can't keep a job. This is so, I'm so fucked up. And I thought, whew. And I had took a second, and I realized that the only way I was going to get out of this alive was if I could talk him down. And so I did my best to kind of relax my body a little bit and lean into him a little bit. And then I pitched my voice a little bit lower as best I could in this frantic moment. And I looked up and I said, Bob, it's me, Joe. Bob, I'm your neighbor. I'm your friend. You know me, Bob. Bob, look, Bob, I'm sure you didn't mean to hit Jane. I'm sure it was an accident. I said, look, man, I said, please, let's just talk things over a little bit here and calm down some. And well, he continued to sob and rant. And so I just kept at it. I said things like, Bob, I know you. I know you're not a bad guy. I know you're not a horrible person. I said, look, Jane loves you. And I know you love Jane. I said, I'm sure she'll forgive you. Come on, man. Come on, please. Let's don't do this. Please don't do this. And I kept at it for a while. God only knows how long, because, you know, things slow down in situations like that. And slow motion. And he started to calm a little bit as I kept talking to him and going, Bob, everything's going to be okay. Listen, Bob, everything's going to be all right. You can get through this. You and Jane can work this out. And he'd start to calm, and then he would tense up and start ranting again. And this went on a couple of two, three times. And because he calmed down about the third time, I said, look, Bob, you know, really and truly, you can't leave these guys like this. I said, look, Jane needs you. Your son needs you. Really and truly, Bob, you're not a bad man. You're really not a bad man. Come on, man, let's just calm down and sort this thing out. And I kept repeating that. And then about the second or third go around after the first three go rounds, I said, Bob, Jane needs you. Your son needs you. And I said, and if you're gone, who's going to take care of your dog? Who's going to take care of that beautiful girl? I said, come on, man, don't do this, really. And somehow, I guess, the talk flipped the switch. Anyway, so he started to calm down, and I kind of relaxed my body some more, and I really literally just sort of leaned on him and leaned into him, and I said, Bob, you know, let's get out of here. This gas is really getting to me. We're really having a hard time because the room was so filled with gas. And just as I thought I had things under control, we both heard sirens in the distance. And I thought, shit, fuck. If the cops get here, there's going to be a confrontation, and he's going to fucking blow us both up. God almighty, you know. And I looked at him, I said, Bob, the cops are coming. I said, look, you don't want to be here when they show up. Really and truly, you just don't want to be here when they come. And I said, and look, Bob, I don't want to be here either. I don't want to have to talk to the cops. You know what? Let's just step outside. The kitchen door's right there. Let's just step outside and get some air and calm things down and catch our breath a little bit. And I took a sort of a half a shuffling step towards the door. And he took sort of a half a shuffling step towards the door. And God only knows how long it took, but we finally got to the door and he unlocked it and we stepped outside and the bright sun just blinded us both. It was like getting slapped in the face because we've been in the dark for so long. And we caught our breath a little bit and I said, okay, Bob, here's the deal. I said, look, the cops don't know what you look like. They don't know what I look like. I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to walk through the backyard and through those bushes into the alley. And we're going to walk slow and easy, like we're just having a little afternoon stroll. And I said, listen, man, if you run, the cops are going to come after you for sure, but they have no idea what we look like. Let's just stroll down this alleyway like we don't have a care in the world, like we're best buddies out for a walk. And so we started down the alley and we're walking and things were starting to calm down a little bit. And then when we got to the end of the alley, I said, Bob, I said, listen, I got to go back. I said, my son's back there. And I said, and dude, I want you to cross that street and keep walking slowly. I said, I'm going to go back and I'm going to stall the cops for as long as I possibly can so you can just disappear for a little while. And I said, whatever you do, don't come back to the house until all the police officers are gone. And he said, okay. And we parted company and I turned around and went back up the alley. And as I rounded the house, oh my God, there were police cars everywhere and lights flashing and fire trucks with their lights flashing and the gas company and paramedics, and half a block was cordoned off and they were trying to keep people away from the house. And when I rounded the corner, my husband spotted me and he yelled, there she is. And he and a couple of cops and a fireman, they came running towards me and they grabbed me hard and fast, which I really didn't need at that point in time, and drug me to safety and then started peppering me with questions. He said, are you okay? Are you all right? Where's Bob? Where's Bob? Is he alive? Where is he? Where's Bob? Is he in the house? Is he still alive? Is he still alive? And I looked at the two cops and they straight in the eye. I lied through my teeth and I pointed in the opposite direction and I said, he went that way. And they took off running in the wrong direction. So I kept my word. I was stuck there for a while because the paramedics had to check me out. The cops were asking me shit tons of questions and the fire department was asking me questions. The gas company was asking me questions and I gave them the best information I could, except for a part where Bob went. And then I looked up towards the edge of the crowd and my young teenage sister-in-law was there with my son in her arms, and Jane was standing next to her, and they were terrified looking. They were just really scared, and I walked up to them, and I said, as quietly as I could, I said, look, Bob is okay. He's still alive. He just went for a little walk, and he'll be back later. And then my sister-in-law handed me my son, and oh my God, I held that baby like it was my last day on earth. I don't know if Bob is dead or alive. I'm guessing he's gone by now because he'd be really old. But I have something to say to Bob, and that is, Bob, wherever you are, out there somewhere, listen. You son of a bitch! You almost killed me! You fucking terrified me! Oh my God! Asshole! And then, you know, Bob, thank you. You did me a huge favor. You really did. I said, look, you didn't kill me, and I want to thank you for that. I learned a really important lesson from you. To this day, some 50-odd years later, I never, ever take for granted that every day that I am on this side of the dirt is a good day.
This is Risk, and this is still John, not Kevin. And this, again, is Genesis back there with In That Quiet Earth. And that story we just heard was from Joe Gentry-Hamer, which I edited and sound designed. Now, since that terrifying day back in 1971, Joe has gone on to some pretty wondrous things. I mean, clearly she spent some time studying under some Noldoran craftsman, because you should check out the jewelry that she and her new husband make. Really stunning work. Have a look at finejewelrycraftsman.com.
We'll be right back. We're back.
Well, that'll just about do it for Dark Sides. Thanks for putting up with me and my nerdy references and music. But listen, Kevin will be back with you tomorrow with that Gina and the Beck story, and then on Thursday with the Best of Queer Lives number 2. There is just a ridiculous amount of Risk coming your way this week. Please take a moment to appreciate that. And my God, the amount of work that goes into bringing these episodes to you, it's a lot. Take it from me. I know. It's not easy to pull this off, and it's not cheap. So please, visit the support tab at risk-show.com and find whatever way best works for you to help fund this labor of love. Today, it's the day. Take a
You fucking terrified me. Oh my God, asshole.
That is what they say I said when they found me in the blackness after 3 hours, with my own cat leaping and tearing at my throat.
Hey, it's me, John. I'm still here. Thanks for sticking around to the end. I want to play something for you. There's this project I've been working on outside of Risk. For the past few months, it's a 4-episode podcast series called Animals of the Maui Wildfires. Remember the fires out in Hawaii last summer? This is what that's about, but it focuses on all the cats and dogs and pigs and other animals impacted by those fires, particularly on the struggle that Maui Humane Society had rescuing and retrieving them in the wake of the disaster. Have a listen and check out the series. I believe the first episode should be out by now.
And she's not paying attention, but I'm paying attention. And I see the rearview mirror. I see the black clouds of smoke. And it's coming their direction. In that moment, fear struck me.
In August 2023, high winds and dry conditions set the stage for disaster on the Hawaiian island of Maui. And on August 7th, a wildfire suddenly erupted and swept through Lahaina, on Maui's western shore.
You could feel the heat off of the metal, or the rock walls, or the road, everything around you. You know, I thought my truck tires were going to melt and I was going to be stuck there and I was going to be on foot.
I'm Marika Bell, CPDT dog trainer, anthrozoologist, and an animal myself. The Deal with Animals is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals. However, this series is going to be something more.
Like, I honestly still have a lot of survivor's guilt, and I have remorse for seeing some of the things that I saw out there that I didn't intend to see.
I should have just left the door open. Like, I should have done this, but it's, disasters are very complicating.
2 months after the island-changing wildfires, my family and I visited Maui, so of course I reached out to Maui Humane Society and asked if we could talk. This podcast series is a result of that conversation, which led to four other conversations with staff of Maui Humane Society.
I felt it was my job to listen. I felt that if I was going to be the person that was going to be communicating the needs of the organization, that I needed to communicate the hardship that people were feeling inside of that.
After that first conversation, I knew this was a bigger story than I could tell in 1 hour. It needed more context. It needed more voices. And it needed to have a purpose.
And even though we are an organization, like really each department is just made up of one or two people or five people at the most, like serving our whole island.
Serendipity, intuition, everything just came into play where the more I was involved, the more I felt called to stay.
We're releasing this trailer 2 months before the first anniversary of those same wildfires in Lahaina and surrounding areas. And over the next 2 months, The Deal with Animals will be running a fundraiser to benefit Maui Humane Society and all the work they do and have done for the animal community of Hawaii. Our goal is to raise $10,000 by August 8th, exactly 1 year after the wildfires. To donate to this fundraiser, we have a special link on our homepage that will take you straight to Maui Humane Society's donation page set up just for this fundraiser. So yes, all of your money will be going straight to MHS. Follow The Deal with Animals now, wherever you listen to podcasts, so you don't miss a single episode. Join me as we ask the question, what's the deal with the animals of the Maui wildfires?
The fire burnt so hot that it even melted asphalt, and we could see paw prints all over the place. These animals went through hell.
Subscribe and donate at thedealwithanimals.com.
Okay, that's it. Thank you. Bye.